This is Terry Gibson, Gnostic Cinema, October 8th, 1994, tape 4 of 4.
So we've got an echo. But he also refers to Jung here, and I thought I'd just read the passage about how powerful Eros is. We've been talking a little bit, all last night we were talking about the Gnostic recovery of the deep soul that's an experience, and recovery of Eros. And this paragraph I think find particularly interesting. At some point, one wants to stand up and demand of all the love merchants, what do you mean by love? He's talking about the fact that we have a culture saturated in the word love in pop psych books, and everybody's talking about love. What do you mean by love? There's a tendency in holistic health circles to regard it as simply as an emotion that has something to do with unconditional caring, compassion, and empathy. That's one side of Eros. This is as fine as far as it goes, but it's only a partial picture. The ancient Greeks, for example, believed that love was the domain of Eros, and Eros was, above all, paradoxical and mysterious. As Jung explained, in classical times, when such things were properly understood, Eros was considered a god whose divinity transcended our human limits and who therefore could neither be comprehended nor represented in any way. In contrast to most New Agers, the Greek recognized that many of Eros's qualities were decidedly, and I like this phrase, not nice.
Yeah.
Jung agreed. As a result of observing the actions of Eros in the lives and dreams of thousands of his patients, he concluded that Eros was a daimon, whose range of activity extends from the endless spaces of the heavens to the darkest abysses of hell, and which contains incalculable paradoxes. So I wanted to kind of introduce, there is this kind of darker and essential element of Eros, which fits in Jungian psychology, the light side and the dark side. But it's real juice. And I think film is about recovering that kind of real sense of juice. And kind of just to review the domain. What's that?
Heroes and psyche,
the myth. Uh-huh. Oh, that's right, the paradoxical quality of Eros. You bet. Yeah. Today we're going to talk, as you remember, you were all here, so we're going to talk about the Odyssey, what I call the Odyssey, the Gnostic Odyssey. This morning we're going to talk about the descent. And a lot of the great Gnostic myths have myths about the descent or the fall into this heavy and material world. And we've got two clips that I want to work pretty hard this morning. One just is kind of a fun throwaway thing we'll start with to kind of re-remind ourselves of the terrain. And I've got a Japanese piece that I think will really work the descent piece. On this afternoon, then we're going to recover what it's like to be at the bottom of the pit, and then we're going to hopefully rise up and get to the Pleroma by 4:30. That's my hope. That was my original goal. So again, just I have several other images today, but this is one possible image. Let me move around here. We're talking about this ego self-axis, and we're suggesting that the Gnostics suggested that most of us are locked in a material world. Actually, this model is almost inverse. This is just what I see when I work with people. The Gnostics will see this at the bottom of being instead of the top as it is in this chart, but it is kind of highly, the material world, H-Y-L-E. And then as you drop down into the unconscious, we get into different realms of what they call pneumatic or psychic experience. We get closer to the lost splinters of light. Freud just first opened up the personal unconscious, and then, of course, Jung opened up this objective psyche with his brilliant looks at what he called persona and shadow and the divine syzygy, the anima and the animus, spirit, quaterni, mandala. But always Jungian analysis in all the great mystical systems of the West, you're trying to get our personal alienated and often empty experience of ego experience related to the deep self. And to get logos in our kind of patriarchal culture, the kind of intellectual, rational control of outer being connected to this paradoxical and divine energy of Eros. And they get Kronos to stop eating his children, if you remember the ancient Greek myth, chronological driven time. Kronos was at Rhea's birth straps, eating all his own children out of fear that one of them was going to do him in. And we're eating our own kids. We're constantly obsessed by clock time. Trying to get Kronos deeply embedded in Kairos, or divine time. And to get this ego self axis functioning. And I'm all along going to suggest that this individuating journey, that what we call as Jungian's individuating journey, is the Gnostic task. It's been around for 3 or 4 millennia, at least, in the conscious part of our cultural experience. Some things I didn't say, but I want to make sure that I'm clear about all day, as we worked through this workshop and last night, I want to make some disavowals that I'm not an expert on film, but I am a lover of film. And I think that's true of everybody here. The older I get, expertise interests me less and less. You know, when I was younger, I was kind of interested in getting to become an expert in stuff, but I'm more and more interested in just enjoying things the older I get and kind of losing expertise. I like Sardello's quote, one of the signs of fragmentation is this growing specialization and focus on expertise. We divide our being into little categories. And we don't go to one holistic physician anymore. We go from one person that grabs one piece of our anatomy to the next. We don't even get all our food in the same place a lot of times anymore. So I want to just be a lover of film. I'm not a Jungian expert, and I'm not a Gnostic expert. Though I am a Jungian practitioner and analyst, and I'm a lover of the Jungian and Gnostic mode. I just want that to, again, as the older I get, I'm less worried about being an expert and more worried about just kind of loving that. I'm not a saint or a spiritual expert, obviously, but I am a sufferer, and I'm more and more appreciative of God or the self-silent and quiet grace in all of this agony that we live in. And I think the Gnostics experienced that paradoxical. The more they saw the darkness of the world, the more they intuited a deeper sense of meaning and power and grace in their life. It's a paradoxical thing. I think the Jungian process is like that. My goals for this whole three-lecture series is to awaken or quicken a love of true art and ascetic experience, which I think is the lived sacred. And I think to hopefully, if you haven't thought about it, to reanimate your sense about what happens when you go to the cathedral that I think is the cinema house. To suggest a frame within which to receive art and film more consciously and transformationally. And to experience the living image as the purest vessel of the spirit whole self, and to see film as our finest crater of image in this cultural moment, which I think it is. I think film affects more people as an art form than any other the art forms that we have currently in our culture. It impacts more people because we're constantly seeing these still images that we call motion pictures. So just to throw away, just to kind of get us back in the mood, a film that I think was, again, kind of a Friday night confection, but I think they're Gnostic themes. It's one of these films. There's been a whole series of films. We talked last night about how when we watch film, we're voyeurs anyway. But this film played on the voyeuristic image even deeper. It was Sliver. I don't know how many of you had a chance to see it when it was so popular. But it's about this. Starts with Sharon Stone plays the main protagonist. She's moving into an apartment building. And she at the beginning, we see a woman murdered. We think murdered. She falls from this giant. And they call it Sliver because it looks like a blade of glass. It's like, and you get that image. A lot of our skyscrapers look like this glass shards just thrown at the end. It's Sliver, this building. And we just see this woman murdered. From her apartment. Sharon Stone becomes the person that moves into this kind of haunted space. It sets it up in the first couple of minutes. It's already a haunted space. And she's in there. And we also, as the film kind of progresses, we notice that somebody, we don't know exactly who, and then later and later you discover that it's the building manager, has had it rigged somehow that he has cameras in every one of the rooms. He's both the building manager. We'll later discover that he's the building owner. But he had a high-tech system installed in the whole building. He's observing everybody, all these 300 units or whatever, and he's got this room where he watches everybody's life. Well, Sharon, we're gonna see Sharon Stone gets involved with him, his light eros and his dark eros. And we're going to see here a little thing, her discovery of the inner sanctum, and kind of just play with that a little bit. It's, as I say, a confection to get us started in themes of where we were going last night. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because the second Japanese film is just wonderful, but to kind of get us back in the mood. Is there a cool turn the lights?
He's coming back here, isn't he?
Who knows if he does?
How will he know he could be there right now?
They're talking about the murderer. She's getting afraid. This is the revelation. I might stop here too, just kind of say that while their love affair is going on, she's discovering, incidentally, parts of her own sexuality and body she's never discovered through this man before. She's discovering a deeper level of her own eros. And yet there's also this growing, the subplot of this mystery, the whodunit, who is the mystery murderer. And we're led to believe, as the film goes on, that one of the possible murderers is a famous writer that's in the building that's kind of been scaring and frightening her. But she's getting frightened, and she asks the question, how will we know who it is? And he says, well, this is where he reveals, I may have an idea about how we may have some secret sources of information. That's what he's alluding to.
You know, my mother was an actress on the soaps. She used to spend most of the year in L.A. I used to take a cab home from school and watch her on TV. I was just about my life with her. I have a custom built in Osaka. It cost me $6 million. He's not there. We'll know if he is, though.
All right. Yeah,
put my apartment on.
There's nobody home there, right?
Put it on. Simple question, Will. You can make me You watch these people?
So do you, Connie, with your telescope.
Oh, shit.
I just said better technology.
You want gossip? I'll give you real gossip. Real life, Carly. Better than any book. Better than any movie. It's a soap opera. It's real life. It's a tragedy, it's funny, it's sad, it's unpredictable. Look for yourself, Carly.
What's wrong?
It's the same as your James Dean book. Nobody gets hurt. You ready? They don't even know.
Then the door is safe.
Look, Carly, don't.
Send me the telescope.
Yes.
Where's the TV? Were you watching Vida when she got killed?
No. The lights had gone down in the stairwell.
What about the others?
I wasn't watching. I just see Gus Hill on the floor of the shower. I was on the call police.
Do you take these?
Yes.
Did you take us?
Would you like to see?
Yes.
So much honesty. Where is it?
You see, sometimes I just let it run on record in one apartment for a while. Like my little soap opera. I don't even have the time to watch much of what I record. It's amazing what I find in some of these days.
Yes. She's going back to work in that scene. How do your bodies fit? I was going to go back to body experience first. What do you notice? Pretty provocative set of images. What do you notice?
I feel sort of a heaviness. More than one place.
Some heaviness. Did anybody feel anything that was opposite of heaviness? Yeah, there's a little bit of arousal, some of them. I mean, there's some arousing images there. If we're all kind of honest. This is something that doesn't happen in a movie theater. They don't stop and say, how are y'all feeling? You know, it's kind of unfair. I'm kind of intruding on your psychic space. But if we're honest, there is something kind of a little bit arousing about this. Kind of stimulating. Sexually, purely, I mean, there's an arousal quality to this. It's carefully designed for that. Well, it's kind of dead. It's just... It's a kind of body shock to discover this kind of room even exists. And of course, our worst paranoid fear, I mean, in this kind of culture is that we're being monitored. And somebody, we all know we carry stuff we don't want anybody else to know about. We all shave warts and we all have secret abuses. There's secrets about our own, what's been done to us and what we've done to others we don't want anybody else to see. And yet our worst fear is that somebody's monitoring our behavior and someday they're going to play it back to us.
But there's that opposite effect of the viewer, the person in the control room, they see everything and suddenly, like the individual who feels their privacy being invaded. On the other side is that you see that there's sort of a normal spectrum of behavior that sort of takes off some of the negativity they might feel about themselves.
Yeah. It sure is the whole sweep of the human experience, isn't it? From childhood... Super saturation, wasn't it? And yet, even like her, I mean, if we were to discover that room, we'd probably go back. Yeah, that was really wonderful. She's ego says, "Hell no, I won't stay." You know, no, I won't go away. I mean, this fascination, whole cycle of the day. She didn't eat. She just absorbed in this, and it is an overstimuli. It's just all the moods and emotions. Oh. And of course, I like the word that there is a tremendous control fantasy thing in here, being able to zoom in, zoom back, get closer, get farther away, get board change. It's tremendous. I mean, what we'd love to have, the kind of control we'd love to have, our whole life is just on a panel, you know, and approach avoidance, we could really have that much kind of control about what came to us out of life and what we usually don't. But it does kind of play into some kind of... That is the first thing. Why doesn't he call CPS? I mean, why doesn't somebody pick up the phone and call Child Protective or a woman's shelter, a woman getting bashed? Why doesn't he do something? Yeah. But early on, he's a watcher. And you need to know that in a funny way, that's the analytic process. Analysts are trained to be watchers. And one of the big debates is, do they even intervene if there's child abuse? If it wasn't required by law, would they intervene? I'm kind of a funny thing. I have both secular credentials, but I'm also ordained. We're the only person in the state that's free. I have the choice of not reporting child abuse. It has to be in the midst of what's clearly a religious act. And since I define my activity as confessional and stuff, I would have that privilege probably and win. It may have been a big case a couple years ago about an ordained person in Renton that didn't report, claiming he was a clergy, but he was working in a secular mental health center, and the court said, no, there you were doing more secular event. But the idea behind it being that there should be a place, the church is held, where even thieves, criminals, rapists, child abusers can come and be free of the king's or queen's law, and the idea that the confession eventually will reform the soul, that even these people will be pulled back from the brink of their own being. And there needs to be some absolutely sacrosanct space that nobody's recording, nobody's monitoring. But it's a tough call, but analysts are just watchers. Ultimately are trained not to intervene. No matter how horrifying you see stuff, you're supposed to receive and not intervene other than just to be there. Now, he's not a very present, and the contract's not known. He's not a very present. Although people tell me stuff about their families. Their families haven't signed a contract. I see all sorts of the inside shelves of family life without people's permission. It's a very voyeuristic profession when you think of it. Just all these rooms. And I got eight hours a day, and every session I've got all these screens that light up as people light up all their aspects of their inner world, and it's a watching without participating kind of thing.
Right. So this is kind of a morality play. I mean, you are given people by when they go to a counselor or a therapist, whatever, they voluntarily give that viewing over to the person, but he's doing it unknowingly. So there's like the moral crime that he's invading people's privacy, but eventually, if something serious happens, he has to go beyond his responsibility as to what he's doing and report.
Although the profession has been voyeuristic, you may know that in the early, the birth of psychoanalysis actually happened at Salt Pitre in Paris with Charcot. And what he went to learn hypnosis because Charcot had revived Anton Mesmer's technique of mesmerizing patients particularly. But it's really interesting, the majority of these patients, it's almost like they put out ads. Funny how many of them were 18 to 28 or 29 or 30-year-old very attractive women that had these sexual hysterias that they would sit them in a kind of an operating room theater with seats all around with these menopausal and postmenopausal age males watching this hypnosis going back to a primal sexual secret, and then she would cathart it, and then the hysterical symptoms would disappear for a while. But if you look at that, I mean, it's not much different than when you're watching here in terms of the kind of purient voyeuristic and intrusions into her life space and not being informed about the full impact of the thing. There's a lot of voyeurism. I think psychotherapy has to think about its voyeuristic kind of components. We don't talk enough about that, but there is.
I felt the heaviness of it slightly.
There's an earlier scene, she kept talking about the telescope. She gets a mysterious telescope, and there's an earlier scene where she gets in and has a setup. She has a party, and somebody knows there's a couple across the way having a sexual experience. And she got shocked. And then everybody got absorbed in looking and yet embarrassed. And suddenly they realized that at a cocktail party and people are seeing them watching this stuff that very interested them, but it should have been a private interest. It'd been a room with nobody there. There is that kind of communal embarrassment that comes when we're seeing primal stuff. Do you get a feeling that the overall mood here is more falling, if you think about a metaphor, or rising? Falling.
What?
As a falling, as a fall. What word would you use to describe that falling? What kind of words are you using? Sinking.
Slow, heavy weight.
Drawn.
Sucked in.
Possessed.
Yeah.
Possessed.
The music adds to that.
Oh yeah. Kind of that subtle. We saw a lot of music in last night's thing. And it was kind of way the artful blending of the kind of music and sound effects. Almost kind of blending psyche's own kind of, the dark psyche's messages. Do you really want to see? Do you really want to see? Well, of course I want to see. Shut up. I want to see it all.
It changes when he starts to come on to her in the real time rather than the synthetic thing. Anybody wants to have this experience, you can go to Future Shop in Tacoma where they have a video wall, which is about 15, 20 feet high and curves around like this. And it's all those. It must be 100, 150 television sets.
Curves around like that?
Yeah.
The ancient serpent. I mean, it's the Garden of Eden serpent scene. Do you want to walk? I mean, that was the snake's invitation. Do you want to watch? You want to eat of the tree of knowledge? Because you eat, you can see everything. You know?
I experience it as a both of thinking and also the paradoxical light enlightening because it broadens the light, it's the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
So there's this light and dark combination.
Yeah, there is that kind of paradox of Eros. And it isn't. It doesn't have. We'll talk about. I think it's a more. I think it's the darker side of Eros. But this is much more alive than the rapture scene last night. The Eros here is much more alive. It's exploring that dark side of it. That makes it. I mean, but it gets a lot of stuff kicking fast. Kind of hard to get revved up last night in a rapture. That was not an erotic scene. I didn't have any arousal at all watching it the first time, the second, or the eighth time. But this scene's got dark stuff. It can kind of. But it is a possessive. And there is a kind of sweet naivete about both Carly and Zeke. Even Zeke has been doing this a lot. Doesn't lose his appeal. There's something touching. What can you think of what's immediately touching about Zeke even when he enters the room? I want you to think about falling because I think there's a reason what they're falling towards, by the way. And I think Zeke prefaces it. And he claims our heart a little bit when he walks into the inner sanctum. You remember what... Yeah, my mother was in the soaps. That's all I ever saw. My mother was watching her on TV. Whose mother is Zeke talking about? Whose mother and father is Zeke talking about? Yeah, all of our mothers, the great mother. In this culture, most of us, because, you know, the Alice Miller says people in helping professions, 90% maybe have major damage to the self, which means 18, in object relations terms, people are damaged the first 18 to 36 months of life because their own parents were so narcissistic or borderline damaged, they couldn't mirror and hold them. They required the child to watch their image on the screen. They never would unconditionally and empathically watch the child's image. It got turned around. So Zeke is telling us how damaged he is. This is a little kid. He has never had any maternal care. What do you get the feeling about that room? What's it? It's room-like again. It's like it's his inner cathedral. It's that vagina. And Jung says, you got to do that mythically and then slay the dragon. But he hasn't slayed the dragon. He's caught in the possession. But what he wants mother. And he wants more than that. What else do you think he wants?
Well, for me, there's a great paradox in that with all that splintering and all that splitting into those splinters or slivers of light, the urge for me was to go toward wholeness. So this greatly dissociated film is creating in me a kind of a Gnostic yearning for the Pleroma. For a whole image, like what I just wanted was them to just switch on one image. Didn't matter which one, but just, you know, something to focus on. And so it's, you know, it's odd.
This, well, where was the one image? That's a wonderful image. All the screens are kind of like splinters of the lost light that have fallen into this heavy material. What one image did she decide to focus on? Yeah, which is not a bad image. She says, "Should tape us?" And then she gets around. Well, that was kind of horrible. But another level, there's an attempt to get some congruent metaphor and some image. And of course, what do you notice between their sex act and what's on the screen? If first happened on the screen and not what happens. So, and all therapists say, it's what you want. When we fall and we're looking for the primal parents again. What I was looking for is, I think Freud is right. There's all in us a hunger for the primal scene. We want to see what it was like when our parents made us conjoined. There's a myth to the primal scene. We all wonder what it was like the night they made love and created us. Was it good love? Was it bad love? Were they a good royal couple or a bad royal couple? Was I conceived in rage or was I conceived in grace? Was I conceived in mercy? Was I conceived in distracted boredom? We all have a hunger for that. I think it'll have a lot of information about. And how does basic therapeutic systems work when you meet with a person? What happens? The image appears on the screen. And you're watching it. And you get aroused. And then what do? They mirror it. There's a mirroring, virtual time, in real time, start mirroring each other. And that's what all deep, any kind of spiritual relationship or love relationship or therapeutic relationship, we're going to see some image of that later on. It's a mirroring. It's an attempt to see the, an archetypal image and then mirror it in our mortal being. And they're trying to mirror, they're trying to make something, trying to touch that other side. The visible world's trying to meet the invisible world. Mirroring is a terribly important metaphor. It's what transference is, and counter-transference, and all the alchemy of the therapeutic process. It's an attempt for that primal mirroring. In the language we've been using here, the ego is trying to look for its mirror in the self. Trying to make the conscious unconscious and the unconscious conscious, to make the two worlds have an erotic connection so that the one whole can emerge. So not a bad intuition on her part. We can't, she probably would have asked, do you have a picture of mom and dad when they made me? Well, he doesn't have that. Or do you have a picture? And he wants a picture of his mom and dad when they made him. He wants to find his real mom in there. And you can know he really wants to find his real dad. He's never going to do it, no matter how many hours. He says, you'll be amazed what you find. And he says, but I never found my mom yet, damn it. You know, he'll look forever. But there is something, you get a feeling, there might be something redemptive in their relationship. And there's that paradox. He both contains her. And then she says, let me free, damn it. And he lets her go. And she comes back her own volition. She returns to this womb. But I think they're looking for that mirroring in their own broken way. But hey, is there a way any more broken than anybody else here in the room in terms of looking for that kind of divine? We're all looking for that mirroring.
The scene when she comes back is very interesting because she turns around and walks away from the mirror. We see her back in the mirror, and we see her in the front. And there's a space created that then allows her to play with it as if it was a toy. Somehow the wind goes down.
That's an important thing. Is there is a certain quality. It's serious and sad, but there is a certain, even as she's regressing and dropping into the possession, there is a playfulness about it. It's a kind of surf, and there is this revert. Who's mirroring who? What's real and what's unreal? What's the mirror and what's real? Is it Memorex or is it? Is it really? Do we know? But there is a kind of quality of play about it. It's kind of sad playtimes, but to get in the unconscious, we have to have that ability to be played, to kind of fall into our possession in a playful way, and they eventually do sex play. That's what the scene ends that way. But there is a predominant mode here, falling. And what I want to suggest to you is, I think it's a falling. I think it's a falling towards recovery of the primal parents, that all of us have been biologically wounded in that Freud's unconscious. Freud was brilliant. And Freud's having a comeback. You know, Kohut, in his rewriting of Freud, you know, most people, Freud is seen as a cartoon. And it's very sad. Freud was a brilliant theoretician, and he was a Jew that took on a dominant Christian culture that was very anti-Semitic and talked about the hidden sexual shadow of the whole culture. And he had it right until 1895. Until 1895, he said, women were literally being violated by their mothers and fathers and brothers. He had it right the first time. He only backed off because I think his own gender training and the enormous reaction to it. In 1895, he changed it from the seduction theory to the wish fulfillment theory. These women weren't really raped and violated by their fathers and brothers. They wanted that, you know, some kind of taboo wish. But Freud unlocked this great personal unconscious. And you know the only, and he wrote about it with such passion. Do you know the only award Freud ever got in his life, significant award? It's amazing, this man that, well, clearly at the end of the 20th century, when we rack up the top 20 names that have had, that shaped the 20th century, Freud will be near the top. He'll probably, and should be ahead of Jung. Maybe if it's maybe anathema, but I think Jung will be on the list. But Freud really cut a lot of ground. What award he got? Significant international award? The Goethe Prize for Literature. If you've never read Freud, there's an amazing number of people that only know Freud in cartoons or textbook summaries, and they know about, yeah, sure, like penis envy, all that kind of stuff. That stuff's absolutely crazy. That kind of cultural stuff. But you go back and read those case studies. They're works of art. You read The Wolfman or Little Hans. They're works of art. There's passion in the way that he writes. As much as he said, you know, got to get, you know, he's going to debunk Moses. Moses is really an Egyptian, you know. This is really part of the primal horde theory. This is just the same thing he's told him to all the men. You know, the sons got together and killed father and innate his flesh to propitiate his spirit so they could have access to all the women. That's what we know it is. I mean, he just wrote that theme over. But he wrote brilliantly, and he wrote with a lot of passion. So one of the things I want to suggest in here at the personal level, we've all been wounded. We all are in search of the missing primal parents. We all have a deep kind of grief about the part of us that was never seen and mirrored. The part of us that was abused and violated and whipped, literally or figuratively. That's happened to every person in this room.
誓約書免許証身分証明書使用許可証権利証認可証登録証携帯許可証組合認証表彰状手形借用証一時許可証承諾証収入証明書保管証さては決定書に至る。果たして証明書はこれでしまいなんだろうか。まだ何か証明し忘れているのではないか。男も女も相手がわざと手を抜いているのではないかと暗い際にのとりこになる。潔白を示すために無理した新しい注文を思いつく。どこに最後の一枚があるのか誰にも分からない。証明は結局無縁にあるらしいのだ。お前は俺は理屈っぽすぎると言って非難した。しかし理屈っぽいのは俺ではなくてこの事実だ。
先生、よう、これからどうなったらね。
どうするって、明日また出直してくるつもりですかね。
でも上りのバスはもうしまいだな。
なるほど。しかしどっか詰まるところぐらいあるでしょ。
止まるってこのグラフィーかね。
いや、ここじゃなくても国道の辺まで出れば。
歩いてですか。
別に急いでるわけでもないから。
そんなことまでせんでも先生さえよければ口を利くぐらいの世話してあげるで。ご覧の通りの貧乏村だが先生さえ構わないだな。
そうですか。そいつはありがたいな。ぜひお願いしたいな。その方が下楽だし、それに僕はこういうところの民家なんかやってもらうのが大好きでね。お願いします。できればその前に一つは来たい気持ちだな。
でも、
いや、なければいいんですよ。
悪いけど明後日まで辛抱してくださいな。
明後日？そうはいかないな。大きく入れて3日目休みしか取ってないな。
すみません。
ランプ一つじゃないの。
Sand pile and he's resting. What's your body sense? Huh? Yeah. Finding that natural slope. Yeah. It gives a panic feeling. A lot of panic. We've been there before. Desperately clawing, looking for the natural slope. I can get out of here scientifically. Scientifically, I can figure out the slope, I can get out of here. We've been there. It's a kind of anxious, kind of body panic. Futile. Oh, yeah. Tesha Gahara gets in under your skin, doesn't he? I mean, you don't even catch him by the tail or in under. It's the sand and grit. It's in our hair. And those were sand scars on her back. It's just sand burns from just it burns and scalds. Sleeping on those mats, it gets in and it scalds and marks. Sand stigmata, if you will. Huh? Horror? Yeah.
Fear of being buried alive by the sand.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's happened. There's been loss of life. We're kind of moving. Let's just remove it.
I feel the same way. I think I might be really a fool. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time stuck down in sand and I'm less trustful of him than her.
Well, let's get into that. This is very interesting. I think we've become.
I feel better in the sand than where his life is. I wouldn't want to try to get out.
Where is ego? Let's talk about where. If we're talking about the perspective of looking at film, I just want to give you these three questions. You can always look for where ego is. Look for where the self is, the clues about where the self is, and the directors, the auteurs, and the film's statement about what the conflict is between the ego's relationship with the self. Where is the ego? Let's start. Where is ego here? It's he. What do we know about our narrator?
I have 3 days.
He's ready. That's right. He's a guy that's got... I mean, we all do. I mean, my God, what is this? I mean, all this stuff is kind of walking. He's got registered cards, licenses. He's got it. Classified. We all got this stuff. We got purses filled with that junk. And he says, and did I remember them all? I mean, we're always one. I mean, and the great panic. I had a client that had an anxiety attack recently, was in Europe and lost their wallet and had a panic attack about it. Can I even get back to the States? It's kind of a desperate thing. Without my registrations, I'm nothing. I'm losing a day and I'm gone. So he goes preoccupied with his registration. He has only 3 days. And what do we know about those 3 days? What kind of sense do we get about the 3 days?
Real active.
Huh? He's real active. Yeah, imprisoning insects. He kind of does that.
He wants to become famous.
He wants to become famous. This is kind of poignant. He's striving to become, at least, and it's a haunting thing. Maybe I'll get my name in the insect books. I mean, when we think about getting famous, that's usually not the place we try to make a big name, but let you know something about the frame of his life. Yeah. Be known by somebody.
Box up what's bugging you.
Yeah. What's driving you buggers? Okay, well, and what do you think a boat is?
A boat could float in the stream, but for him it looks like a boat.
Well, and what do we notice about this boat? What kind of boat is this?
Rowboat.
It's a rowboat, and it's landlocked. It's a landlocked rowboat. Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. What do we notice about him in the boat? Huh? Well, he relaxes. He's actually inside the boat. The boat provides a perimeter. Jungians would call that what? A container, the temenos. It's a temenos. By the way, he's wandering across. The thing starts. We're wandering across. And the directors say he's wandering across, what, sand dunes, yeah, the outer wilderness. What else does the director clearly note, even from the beginning, about where he's wandering? He's wandering in the outer visible world, but where do we get a clue from the very beginning? We see it only twice, and it's real subliminal, very cleverly inserted in the beginning here. Do you see images? We see the mech, huh? Well, there's an image of woman, but even that there's a microcosmic image of the microscopic world. He's wandering in the macrocosm, but Tesha Gahara really wants us to know it's deliberate. He's wandering, even more importantly, in the microcosm, the microscopic. That first image that comes up right after I wanted you to see the director's credits, and then it's just there a bit. He says, "What is it? Well, you're working real fast. What is it?" But all you can notice is the microcosm. Then we're on the sand dunes, and then it appears. It's just inserted, like a subliminal flash of consciousness. It's inserted later on in the middle of dialogue inside the house. We see that image again. Remember? Whew, goes by so fast. Tesha Gahara clearly wants us to know this is an inner journey and an outer journey, the visible and invisible. And to do that, all the great mystical traditions of the world, all the great therapeutic and healing traditions say you must have a temenos. You cannot enter the world without a protected space. We're going to see a clip from The Last Temptation of Christ where Katsanzakis is Christ. Jesus knows that you've got to have a temenos before you do this work. So the temenos is the boat. Temenos. T-E-M-E-N-O-S.
a protected enclosure. And any kind of great spiritual or analytic experience requires a timonos. In fact, you could draw some, this is some amplification, I don't know if there's any conscious awareness, but do you, what's a common container, popular containers in our culture outside of analysis? What are popular containers? Just churches. And what is a church's, you know, the great basilicas, what do you call the main aisle in the great Gothic cathedrals in Europe, do you know? The nave. And do you know what nave is in Latin? Boat. What is this guy in? He's in a nave. He's in a boat. He's in a container. He's in a timonos. I think the director, and clearly, and what can you do in it? What do you do when you get in a container? What do you have to do? You have to surrender ego control and consciousness. Does he do this? He's back. He surrendered. Yeah.
One of the first things they showed was a caterpillar crawling across the sand. I thought that was kind of metaphorical because the caterpillar is an organism that goes through transformation in the sense that they go from the caterpillar to the cocoon stage or sort of trapped inside and they break out eventually as a moth or butterfly.
So one, it's a metamorphal, it's another image of metamorphosis, and also an image that this is happening at the instinctual. You know, Jung said that our culture is so cut off from the instinct. We're so up in our head. We're so up in the big things, the big spiritual picture. Patriarchy wants to get the big spiritual controlling picture things, that it loses a microcosmic and instinctual perspective, and it's the little things, the least of these things. It's a caterpillar, it's a metamorphic. So we get, and he's in an obvious, and the first thing he knows what to do, he knows how to, it's a place ego surrenders. And he doesn't, what kind, is he in Kronos or is he in Kairos when he surrenders, by the way? Kairos, and how do we know he's in Kairos? Part of him, yeah, part of him, he's not fully there, but he's struggling to get there. He pops in and out all along. Well, what's the biggest metaphor for Kairos? When does our culture say the only time you can have Kairos, really? Your vacation. That's the only time you can have Kairos. And the culture says, don't take too much of it. And it's kind of niggardly about giving us much Kairos. They dole it out in little amount. A little Kairos can go a long way, and it's dangerous stuff. You know, if you let people out in Kairos too long, they may not come back, you know? That's like a big metaphor. Do you lose it? Well, he is in Kairos time. He's on vacation. The Kronos warrior, you only got 3 days, though. I'm going to eat your babies. I mean, you know, he knows he keeps checking his watch. He's got to be back at that emptiness. But he's in Kairos. Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things. Kronos notices it's 8, and then he drops into Kairos time. Anyway, he realizes he slept, what does it look like, about 13 hours? No, it was 15 hours. It was 8, and then he wake up at 11-something? I mean, he was, another thing, what does that tell us about? What's another metaphor? What is ego's state? Has ego got a lot of energy? Is ego exhausted? Oh, ego's exhausted. Ego's exhausted with the burden of what, Gnostics would say. What's his burden? On carrying all the certifications, on all that alienation. He's a very alienated, sad, lonely man. He's in the pits. He's in the pits. He's in these metaphors. He's going buggers. And he's driven by Kronos. And he drops in. But clearly he's on vacation. He's working a little bit and he gets to that. And of course, what's the metaphor that relaxes him? He's a good patriarch. He's struggling up the desert. And he's just like the ancient, you know, church mothers and fathers are going. He's just struggling out there. But what's the first sign that he's beginning to relax even before he gets to Nave? Before he gets to the boat? What's the first thing? You just see him sigh when he sees this metaphor. Most ancient metaphor for the unconscious there is. The sea. You know, it's like when we go to the sea, even when we live close to it. She welcomes us. She invites us to surrender. And you can see him relax. There are ancient. I mean, my spouse and I are in this thing about trying to sell one house and get another. It's just a nightmare. And you always want to time it just right. You want to sell your house one day so you can just move in the other one. Right? And it never works out. It's just. And Kronos has got thousands of papers to sign. It's a simple thing about a home. But our culture just makes everything. Kronos makes it different. But I was working hard. But that harvest moon we had a couple weeks ago. Well, I came home. I live in just a wonderful, youngest tree in the place, 110 years old. There's some trees that are 300, 400, 500 years old. And it's a packed grove and a little brook. And I came home last night. And the woods always have these little tunnels, even with all the thickness. And I got out and I heard it always relaxing to come home in the dark. And I live up on the flanks of a near, and I can look up and just see the night sky. There's usually no smog in the air. It's kind of clean. I hear the brook. But right through the tunnel, that full moon just caught me. Full through the trees. And I must have stood there 20 minutes. First time I breathed all day. The Kairos comes. It's the way the earth arrests us. And of course, this film has all three of the aspects that Sardello says for a recovery of Eros. The ancestors are clearly here and her sense of the community spirit and the ones that went before and the ones that go beyond. The land is vividly there. And the film is filled with archetypal images. We'll talk more about that, but it's filled with an archetypal. It has all of Sardello's three criteria for the arousal of Eros in the present. When Eros is around, look for these three things. These things will perform. And the sea is there. The primal, you know, the sea, Mare. The great unconscious. And he has good instincts. He knows exactly what to do. He goes to get a sacred enclosure. It's a boat. But it's paradoxical. It's a paradoxical boat. It's not going to float. It's not going to get loose on the tide. You know, it's landlocked, but it's a boat. And he has to do this mantra to let go. It's his own kind of chant. It's his meditative chant. He chants the names of all his registrations. I mean, it's a kind of interesting mantra. It's his own kind of Zen prayer. It's to channel his, you know. He does that, and he lifts the sand. And then how do we know the unconscious, that the self is beginning to manifest and constantly? He's closure. He's starting, one thing is he's relaxing. And it is kind of interesting. I don't think it's by accident. It's a kind of a phallic reaction. You notice he's got the thermos there, right? Did you see that kind of image? He's got the dirger. He's got this. He can't, you know, men have got to be protected, but he's there. But he's going to say, he's letting go. What's the first sign that the unconscious is coming? That is constellating to him. First image. He has a, she's above. There's this wonderful sub in the image, and it blends into the rhythms of the sand. That Mother Earth herself is deeply feminine. She's filled with Eros. He sees her contours, the body and the contour. The Sophia constellates to him. She's above. She's about the 32nd level of Valentine. She hadn't fallen all the way. She's caring. And she's just above him. She knows his name. It's a discovery. Nobody else knows his name. Even with all these numbers, nobody. And nobody's going to look for him if he disappears. I got a Social Security number, but I think it'll take Washington a long time to figure out that somebody's not paying on that if I disappear. I mean, I want to believe that, at least by April 16th, they ought to know and send a party, but they're not going to. But she knows him. She knows him. She cares. And she broods over him. It's a brooding image. It's touch. She's really she's a feminine figure of mercy. There's no judgment in her. There's a mercy to her. And then, anyway, he wakes up. And of course, you know, this like a lot of films, we could say what's virtual and what's real. Is this a dream? Is it real? But he wakes up and the villagers are there. And of course, they're cunning shadow figures, aren't they? Well, last bus is left. Anyway, your place to stay kind of appeals to his worry about exposure. Well, we got some nice places around. Nice folks out there. You like this. Try it, you'll like it. Well, and then, and of course, obviously the descent, ego. And of course, what's another sign of ego's burdens, by the way, as he's marching towards his place of descent? As we see him all along, what's a sign of ego's burdens? All the junk. And you laugh at him, but every time I go on a vacation, if I'm going away for 3 days, I cram the trunk with, I take 40 pair of underwear, you know, and 30 cameras, and stuff I never use. All my, I got a kit bag, it's my neurosis. I got a bag packed with all my camping gear. I was with my friends last weekend, a couple of analytic colleagues, and we get together, and we really have a lot of love for each other, but I throw, it's got my tent, my backpack, my boots, my water boots, it's got everything, and I never use any of it, but it's in the trunk, and I just throw it in there, and it relieves that anxiety. But we always take, Cronus says, be prepared. You know, the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, be prepared. Well, he's got all this junk, and you know, looks like he's choking him to death. And then that ridiculous torture, or kind of, notice if you get lost in the dunes, here I am. It's kind of his own little dune buggy stick with his wife. I don't know quite what he uses that for, but he's heading off. Well, it's got a butterfly. Is that the butterfly net wrapped around the top of that stave? You see him with the net? So that's what that is. I thought he's afraid to get lightheaded and torch himself. You know, or you see his dune buggy so that they don't get lost. They got that thing flashing and the thing. But no, I know, it's a butterfly. But he's got all of the junk that Cronus says we need to keep off fear.
He's finally willing to put it down, and he's trying to climb out. He's trying to
survive. Well, it's panic.
One thing I was noticing toward the beginning was the constant repetition of the dunes, you know. And then there was
and the Gnostics would say, yes, you've got it. That's what this fallen world is. It's a constant repetition trap. We're just lost in the sand, and we'll never get to the highway. We'll never get out. We'll, you know, that's the way this world feels. And, of course, throwing that stuff off, you had to have, when I saw that first, I remembered when I was a younger man, I used to guide folks in the Appalachian Mountains. We took hard-boiled inner-city kids. It was a project, and the Appalachian Mountain Club, and I and about four or five others would take them up for these 3 or 4 weeks to kind of break them down. They ended up breaking us down, but it was these tough streetwise kids that had never been any farther than 10 minutes from these tough neighborhoods. And once we got them up, and we made a mistake, hadn't watched the weather, and we had a party of 10 of these kids, and there was one other guide and myself, and we got it, and we were actually in a thunder cell, not above it, not below it, but the lightning was crossing right in front of you on the trail and blowing rocks apart, and you could smell the brimstone. And all of us, you don't know anything about lightning, and I remember all of us, the first thing is, we're all wearing metal packs. You should have seen that stuff fly off the backs. It's a sink of ego's panic. I mean, there's just no thought. And I was just panicked. Just get rid of this gear. Don't mark me. Don't expose me. So we got a good sense of ego. We got a sense of where ego is. Ego is chronological obsessions, obsessions with identity. But if this were your patient, if you were a spiritual director or a therapist, and they came to you, always what you have to do is in the first session, you got to decide whether there's much hope for our relationship. And in the material, there's any kind of hope that this person has an ego flexibility and a real genuine desire to fall. A lot of people don't. If this guy came in, just kind of, if he got back to town and reported this story to you and said, and I'm feeling full of despair and had this weird story, and he told you this, or I said, I had kind of a dreamlike experience, I don't know what's true or not true, would there be any hope in this man? Would you have hope for this ego? Why? What kind of hopeful signs do you have?
That he
could surrender, that the guy has a capacity in the right setting when he's safe enough to kick back. That's a good sign. It's a very good sign to look for. That he can surrender to paranormal experience. And that he can allow her to come to him and he can hold her image. Another thing is he can remember her image. What's another good sign about the prognosis of this? Yeah, he stays away. He struggles, he panics. But there's a kind of an endearing perseverance and stubbornness about this guy. If he decides that there's no wood beetles around here, there's no wood beetles. He'll stick with it. But can he change? Yeah, he eventually can change. He can eventually wear it down. He's a patriarch that can change. And when he gets to the top of the dune, what's he do? If you tell him the story, lets us know this guy's willing. Is he pushed down into that? No. He says, oh, rope ladder. And then what else does he say as he's starting to make his descent? He's quite an adventure. Well, that's exactly what it is, Bob. More than you know. I sometimes feel like that. I've had that happen when somebody's cared for me, and I stand up on the end. You're saying more than you know. You know, Jung's famous expression that's reported on numerous occasions by some of that first generation of analysts that did therapy directly with him. And he's one of his favorite greetings. Very empathic, the heartfelt. So you're in the soup too. You're willing to surrender into that part. And he's willing. Quite an adventure, says he.
It's pretty trusting.
Yeah. He's got kind of a little bit naive. He's going to get an edge. He's going to learn to read shadow sign a little more clearly. I mean, that's one of the things. Dark areas, you've got to read shadow sign. Our culture's not trained to read shadow sign. I heard an NPR thing the other day about, apparently Meryl Streep's the new film about the River Wild, and he said they hired a woman that does the Tashashini up in Alaska, which is one of the wildest rivers in the world, and they hired her to look at the film and say, does she look like a real river runner? And apparently she actually did a lot of her own stunts in this film. They actually went to some wild river, and they had almost missed her a couple times. They had this nylon cable that caught it just short of some of these huge cats. To get it real, they got cameras actually in, and she had to train for 2 months to get a lot of upper body strength, and she's doing a lot of the actual rafting in the film. And apparently a couple times they lost her and the crew, and she dumped once. But they had some expert look at her and say, well, did she look real? And she said, oh, yeah, she's dressed so she looks real. Life jackets are phony. That's Hollywood. You never go in a river. Those aren't standard. But she said, what's different about a man and a woman running a river? Well, they said, men have a lot of upper body strength, but they rely on it too much. They can pull it out more at the last minute. But women have much more of a relationship and read the signs a lot better and spot the shadow stuff. They don't shoot in the shadow, but they spot the dangers a lot earlier. This guy's going to have to learn a lot about spotting shadow sign a lot early. He didn't read sign very good, which is kind of I always think if I get in a corner, I can power my way out of it. So there's a certain kind of nice, but he does have a capacity to, there's a kind of poignant goodness about him to trust first and then before he distrusts. And he's a little slow on the uptake, but when he gets there, I think I'd have been wound a little tighter a lot earlier when I think about my, but any other kind of signs of ego resilience in him? He has a sense of humor. He does. He does. He can laugh. Where's the self? We got a good sense about you. You're very good. Well, one image of this self is the desert itself. I mean, the desert, the image of that. And the desert is a universal. Whenever you need to, where do you go find God? You go to the desert. Where do you go? Listen, we're going to see this in the last temptation. Where do you go find God? You go to the desert. That's where the divine is. And, of course, all the great shamanic traditions, the primitive traditions, the primitivistic and naturalistic traditions say, the closer you get to prime, to the prime area, the better. And it's at extremes. Extremes of time, either midnight or early morning, or extremes of weather, very cold or very warm, and extremes of terrain, desert or high mountain. That's where you go and find. You push the envelope. You go to the frontier. So he's in the desert. So one symbol of self is the earth. The sea we've talked about is another. The self shows we know the self is there. Where's another image of the self? Well, sure, clearly there's anima figures, and it's clearly a male director's film, but the constellated image of a Sophia hovering above him, what I call Sophia. So there's that image. Where else is the self?
And the vulnerability of the body.
Oh, she just pervades. The directors, think about the first images you saw of her, some of the first. What did that remind you of in Western art?
Madonna.
Some of her best images, that wonderful, full black and white cameo of her, all black. That is the ancient face, the Sophia of Mercy, of the Magdalene, if you will. Mayen, it is the feminine mediatrix of the deep divine. I mean, it's a very touching image. That still It's often associated with this in the publicity photos when it came out. That's a wonderful, that's a Japanese Zen Madonna. It's kind of a Japanese Our Lady of Guadalupe. It's a one. Clearly, she just carries it in her body. And another sign of his health, I think, of his ego strength was he was aroused by it, but in a deep way. The kind of childlike way he was just sitting and meditating and enjoying her body and kind of shy about it. That's very touching.
She herself was like the dream that they were bringing to
him. Oh, yeah. She is of the earth. I mean, she lives in there. She's of the elements. She works by the elements. She works through the night. She clearly, where does the feminine work in a patriarchal culture? She works all night. Works Luna under the phone. She's working all night. And her house, she can grow cucumbers on her flesh. She says the roof can, but her body, and the body of that house, and the body of the dunes, it is the earth itself. It's the primal material. Clearly, she just reeks with self, and it's grounded. And she's clearly a teacher. And is there all lightness to her? No, she's got a nice trickster quality to her. Where did you see some kind of trickster qualities to her? She's got a nice trickster energy. And you got to remember too, this is 1964 Japanese culture where women are very subservient. Oh, it should right away. No, this would be. It's a lot of moisture. No, desert's dry. Everybody, the paradox. He doesn't know about paradox yet. She's teaching about paradox. Oh no, I guess we get so much moisture here. Rots the beams in the roof. You can grow cucumbers up there, idiot. You want a little more to eat? Would you like a little more to eat? It is still a wood beetle. I mean, she's got a real trickster quality. She's not going to put up with guff. And a Japanese thing, I mean, that was quite shocking in 1964 to see a woman be so assertive directly with a first time. Where's another sign where you get a sense of her goose?
The honey.
Yeah, she's... house shakes and she's under these kind of conditions, but she's really poignant. And think about her in the dark when she's working the first time. He comes out stumbling out with a light and... you're working on it all night. Do you mind doing this? You remember what the little trickster thing she did? He's got the light. Yeah! Boom! I mean, there's a, out of the way, buddy. I mean, she's, don't get in the way. You know, you guys, you're going to have to learn to get on track here. It's playful. There's a playful eros, but she's got an edge to her. There's a lot of strength to this woman that you can see. She's going to teach him about deeper things. And, of course, thinking about what we talked about with Sliver, and what I said was the key element of Sliver. Key thing to think about is you're falling into the unconscious. What are we falling towards? What did I suggest you're falling towards? Biologically, in our personal life, what do you have to fall with? Our own loss in the first part of our life. Where does she give voice to the loss of innocence? She voices it when we know that she carries it archetypally and she carries it personally. She lost her husband and child. There it is. It's always there. The primal loss is footnoted in it. And it's not her loss. It's also his loss of the primal family. She's not only lost the primal family, he doesn't know yet. He hasn't learned to read the sign, but he's there because he's lost his primary family. He's terribly alienated because he's looking for the primal parents he never had, and the compassion and mercy and a sense of divine, a sense of... he's looking for... she speaks for him, not just for her. And he's moved by it. He's moved by it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does have that kind of... it has an arcoid... kind of quality. It is a fairy tale. This house at the bottom of the... I mean... Yeah. She's like a shape changer. She could... one minute you could almost expect her to be a wise old crone and then be a lizard. And maybe she is all... maybe she is the woman in the dream. She is the caterpillar. She is the villagers. Maybe she's all things. Yeah. No, but what you're asking, do you have any idea about what does happen? What is the caterpillar is a symbol for Christ. Do you have any idea? Probably most of you have not seen this. Huh? No. That would be kind of a film, a Japanese film noir way to end it. There would be agnostics who like that ending. But do you have any idea what happened?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.